Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of Medicare payment information that has been blocked since 1979 that reveals $26 million in payments to an ophthalmologist in Florida for seeing 900 patients and a cardiologist who got $23 million in Medicare payments in 2012, 80 times the average billing for cardiologists. Max Richmond, a former staff director of the Senate Committee on Aging and president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, joins us to discuss how much this alarming data will be used as ammunition for those wanting to cut Medicare and how much could be saved by going after these apparent fraudsters. Then we'll go to Doha, Qatar to speak with Clayton Swisher, the manager of investigative journalism for Al Jazeera, who is the author of The Truth About Camp David and The Palestine Papers, The End of the Road, which is based on the 1,600 files of leaked confidential records of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks entrusted to him and published by Al Jazeera and The Guardian in 2011. We'll discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Isn't It Time to Try Something Else?, and assess the possibility of using the latest collapse of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks as an opportunity to try a different approach to the bankrupt decades-long peace process that has been all about process but not peace. Then finally, Eric Liu, the founder of Citizen University, who served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Clinton, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. We will look into how Paul Ryan, whose budget wants to cut the top tax rate from 39.6% to 25%, has the wrong focus when he asserts that we have a culture of poverty in America when it appears we have a culture of concentrated wealth, and that picking on the poor misses the point that the playing field is increasingly rigged against those who aspire for the American dream. Joining us now is Max Richmond, who is a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging and a 16-year veteran of Capitol Hill. Currently, he is president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education membership organizations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Richmond.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
And the lead article in a number of papers across the country, including the Los Angeles Times, titled Release of Medicare Doctor Payments Show Some Huge Payouts. And there was a picture of this doctor in Florida, in West Palm Beach, Florida, where there are a lot of retirees. He topped the list by taking in more than $26 million to treat fewer than 900 patients. Apparently, that's 61 times the average Medicare payout of $430,000 for an ophthalmologist. And then second on the list is a Florida cardiologist who received $23 million in Medicare payments in 2012, which is 80 times what the average for a cardiologist is. So these headlines and this information, Max Richmond, is very likely to be, you know, grist for the mill and be a gift to the enemies of Medicare.
Well, I hope that's not what happens, because this information is really long overdue, and it's I think it's a credit to the Health and Human Services Department and Center for Medicare and Medicaid that they've made this available to the public. I know there was opposition to releasing this from the medical community, but this is going to be a big positive step for the Medicare program and for beneficiaries, for consumers. So, you know, let's learn from this. So, consumers will now, especially if a method is devised to distribute this information in a way that's really usable by Medicare beneficiaries, so that they can actually compare doctors and treatments in a way they've never been able to do until now. We're not quite at that point of refinement of the data yet, but I hope it's coming. I was on a conference call with the department today, and we urge that there will be an avenue to disseminate this information in a form that is useful to the beneficiary. But just as important, I think it's going to help us identify where there is possible overuse of medical procedures. I think fraud investigators are going to find some of this very useful in identifying, just from the volume of procedures by certain members of the medical community is not conclusive of any kind of overuse of medical devices or techniques, but I think it's going to provide an avenue to look at where there may be some abuses. So I think we should be grateful that we have this information, that the public has it, that those that can look at how Medicare is spending its money can hopefully focus on ways that the money is misspent. Because let's face it, you're right. There are and have been for many, many decades opponents of the Medicare program, just as there are opponents of the Affordable Care Act. But what we, instead of cutting the Medicare program, let's find out where we can save money and use those resources in the most efficient and positive way possible. So I'm hoping that this information will be a positive for both the Medicare program and for the consumer. That we're going to do our part to see that is a direction it goes.
Well, Max Richmond, it does look as if this is also a little, perhaps even a lot, to do with money in politics as well. It turns out that this ophthalmologist in Florida, Dr. Salomon Melgen, the ophthalmologist who billed the government $26 million to treat fewer than 900 patients, he is a heavy political donor to Senate Robert Menendez, the Democratic senator of New Jersey. And apparently federal officials are looking into him. I mean, it's pretty surprising that somebody could bill that much. I mean, the guy must have been working 48 hours a day.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't know exactly how much he worked. We don't know how much of, for example, did he have of a high volume because he oversaw other medical residents or physician's assistants, and those bills are incorporated. I don't know. But, you know, on its face, it is obviously a lot of money going to one practitioner. But I think it's important to understand, and I know there have been some investigations into this particular individual. But I think we, instead of jumping the gun, we ought to be sure we know what we're talking about. And as I say, you know, even if there is if there's a small community that is abusing the process, this information will help us identify that, and that's a good thing, because we need to start looking at how to improve the Medicare program, and there isn't a lot of extra money to do that, but there may be some resources that can be derived from overpayments if they can be identified. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but I do a lot of town hall meetings with seniors around the country, with members of Congress mostly, and I keep hearing, why doesn't Medicare cover vision or dental or hearing aids? These are so important. There's very little money to expand the program. But if there are ways to identify savings, that are money that's now, resources that are now being spent in a way that is not the best, maybe we can shift some of that money into what's really needed, some of the gaps in what Medicare does cover. So I'm hoping that we can get some good out of this information. You know, transparency was kind of a hallmark, one of the hallmarks of the Affordable Care Act. And I think this just continues on that path of transparency. And generally, the expression that sunlight is the best disinfectant, I think transparency here will be positive. I'm hoping it will.
Again, I'm speaking with Max Richmond, who is a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging and a 16-year veteran of Capitol Hill. Currently, he's the president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education membership organizations. So what was the reason then for the decades of secrecy in terms of this list of doctors and what they were billing? that goes, it was legally blocked back in 1979, so it's obviously taken a long time to get the transparency
right.
that you just mentioned.
Well, yes. It's my understanding that the medical community did what it could to prevent this this kind of information from being made public. Part of the argument that was made is we had to be sensitive to medical privacy, and there was concern. This was the argument. I'm not saying I bought it, but it was the argument for blocking the release of this information, you know, citing privacy concerns, possible potential for misuse of this information. But a federal judge ruled last year that it could be made public. The information was there. It just was not made public. So I think it's interesting that the medical community, specifically the American Medical Association, did not appeal that. They, I guess they thought the time had come to acquiesce, and they stopped trying to use the legal process to block releasing this information.
So, Max Richman, apparently the majority, overwhelming majority of doctors billing the government bill in very modest amounts, and apparently 2% of healthcare providers account, but nevertheless 2% of healthcare providers account for 23% of the Medicare fees, according to this new data that's now been made available to the public. So it sounds like the investigators at least can, you know, their focus can be narrow now. You just go after the 2%, right, and start auditing
them.
Well,
I think there are other issues that investigators pursue, but I think it does provide a useful tool to, on the surface, at least begin identifying where there's a large volume and are these are there doctors that perform many more tests than other doctors in the same general environment, and that would be a sign that more research needs to be done to whether there has been abuse of some kind or fraud. But you're right. Most practitioners of medicine are paid, I think it's less than $60 a visit by a Medicare, a reimbursement by a Medicare patient. So, you know, most doctors are not overpaid, I don't think, by Medicare. Many of them think that it's barely enough to keep up with the actual cost of providing care and making a small amount of profit. But there may be abuse, and this information will help fraud investigators, and it will help consumers, Medicare beneficiaries, sort through some of this information once it's provided in a clear format for them.
Well, just on the surface, if the Medicare billing for 2012 totals $99 billion paid to these healthcare providers, and if 23% of them, or 2%, responsible for 23% of the billing, then you can just do the math, and that could save the taxpayer $20 billion, or $20 billion could go into what you're talking about, particularly dental care, which is not covered. And one of the
absolutely. I mean, I think it's worth exploring, but you know, we need to make sure we're comparing apples and apples. You know, an office visit, routine office visit, you wouldn't expect it to have the same reimbursement rate for an ophthalmological surgery procedure or or a radiation procedure. So we have to, it's really the, what I think this will be very useful in looking at, are there identifiable practitioners who, based on these numbers, are using excessive medical procedures and doing so just to run up the bill. And I think this information will be useful.
Well, Max Richman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I appreciate the invitation. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Max Richmond, who's a former staff director of the Senate Special Committee on Aging, a 16-year veteran on Capitol Hill, and currently he's president and CEO of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, one of the nation's most influential senior advocacy and education membership organizations. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking about the collapsed Israeli-Palestine peace talks and whether it's time to try something else.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Clayton Swisher, who's the manager of investigative journalism for Al Jazeera, based in Doha, Qatar. He's the author of The Truth About Camp David and The Palestine Papers, The End of the Road, based on 1,600 files of leaked confidential records of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks entrusted to him and published by Al Jazeera and The Guardian in 2011. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Isn't It Time to Try Something New? Welcome to Background Briefing, Clayton Swisher.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And the opinions you're about to express are yours, right? Not necessarily those of Al Jazeera.
Definitely not.
So let me ask you then about Tuesday's Senate Foreign Relations hearing, where Secretary of State Kerry really did get grilled, and his colleague, or perhaps former colleague, Senator John McCain of Arizona, really got under his skin by saying, in terms of the Middle East peace talks that appear to be in collapse, he says to Kerry, you're about to hit the trifecta, failure to reach a political settlement in Syria, failure to strike a nuclear deal with Iran, and the collapse of talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians, to which Kerry said, well, it's a tough issue, and glaring at his former colleague said, but your friend Teddy Roosevelt also said the credit belongs to the people in the arena who are trying to get things done. You know, this arena that he's talking about, it's called the peace talks or the peace process, but it's about process. It's not about peace. And that's why I find your article refreshing. That, you know, it's a sort of wake-up call. You know, who are we kidding here?
Well, I appreciate that, Ian. Well, I guess my thought would be that Senator McCain is in the same arena as John Kerry, whether he recognizes it or not, because the U.S. Senate is very part of the enabling of the continuation of the Arab-Israeli conflict by giving unqualified military and financial aid to the Israelis. So, you know, whether, you know, he's turned this into a partisan issue from what you've just described by, you know, saying that this is going to be their failure, but this has been a bipartisan failure over the last several decades. Republican and Democrat have been wholly, I wouldn't say worthless, because that would imply that they didn't do any harm. They've been wholly ineffective. And not only resolving the conflict, but worse off, they've made it so that a two-state solution most probably isn't possible by decades of heavily biased mediation, which is, you know, why I wrote the article I did.
So does this come down to the fact that this process needs adult supervision? In other words, you know, if you got two drunks in an alley trying to slash each other with broken beer bottles, somebody has to referee, right? I mean, the honest broker, which is supposed to be the referee, is really what's absent and has been absent here, I take it.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We're a country of 313 plus million people, yet we have the same tired retreads that served, you know, under the Reagan administration, under the Clinton administration, under the Bush administration. They cycle in and out, and they have the same pro-Israeli views. They write about how America must give unqualified support to Israel, that we can never be seen as pressuring them. They write position papers in think tanks that condemn the Arab side, and then they're invited into high-level national security posts where they're making the very policy that they were writing about from the outside. It just begs the question of why one has to have staunch pro-Israel credentials to represent U.S. national security in a part of the world that has profound implications for American homeland security. I don't think the public knows that to be a mediator in the Arab-Israeli conflict, you virtually have no chance unless you have worked for AIPAC, WINEP, or a think tank that has strong pro-Israeli views. And that level of bias has served neither the United States nor the Arabs, but one could easily argue neither has it served Israel, as they've taken on apartheid-like features, and again, as I said, the two-state prospect is as distant and arguably remote as possible.
So, in effect, you're arguing that the United States ends up talking to itself because its negotiators are sort of pre-cleared by Israel, and most of the top slots in the National Security Council and the key positions in state and defense seem to be given to those that pass the AIPAC test. I mean, a perfect example of that would be the Dean of American Diplomacy, Ambassador Chaz Freeman, who by all accounts is one of the most brilliant ambassadors the United States has ever had. He was the translator between Richard Nixon and Mao Zedong at those secret talks in China that brought about the rapprochement with China. He was a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, and he was nominated by President Obama to head up the National Intelligence Council and was run out of town because the fact that he spoke Arabic as well as Mandarin Chinese was a strike against him, for God's sake. I mean, this is how bizarre it is.
How dare he learn a critical language that Americans desperately need to know. I mean, I happen to know Ambassador Freeman quite well from my years in Washington, and you're absolutely right. He's remarkably intelligent and, one of the most capable people that could have filled that job, and it absolutely came down to the Israel lobby putting out a campaign against him, not unlike the way they did Senator Hagel, which was the most brazen attempt by the lobby that I've seen to try to derail a confirmation. They've organized over the decades, and they're very effective at torpedoing the career of anyone who doesn't swear absolute fealty to Israel. And by Israel, they mean the Likud party. And this is the time that now, if we don't, if Secretary Kerry says it's time to take stock of the process, well, that includes looking back at these last several decades of what has not worked and what has really not worked, because nothing has worked. And the constant you'll see throughout that is biased U.S. mediation, and mediation that is biased heavily in favor of Israel. And I said in my article in the Huffington Post, when I researched for my book on Camp David, I interviewed several Israelis who told me that the U.S. bias at the negotiating table actually hurts them. One, the Arabs are always suspicious. They don't actually trust the U.S. as a neutral, unbiased broker. But it creates different bargaining relationships where at some times the United States will, in some instances outdo the Israelis or try to outdo the Israelis in positions that are unhelpful. And I think that was seen at Camp David, where some of the American mediators were less ready to see Israeli concessions on, for example, the issue of Jerusalem than the Israelis themselves. So this is them trying to be more Catholic than the Pope, so to speak. And for the Arabs, you got to say this is maddening. They're turning to the world superpower who enables this conflict, who keeps them, the Israelis protected at the UN Security Council, and they're hoping to see, a little bit of even-handedness. They don't see anything of the sort. If they're going to take pause, and what I wrote was they should meditate on the past failures and try to mediate new ones. That's exactly what Senator Kerry needs to do. He needs to take a hard look at his team, ask himself, why did he bring in these failed retreads, and where is he getting his advice from? And frankly, I didn't get a chance to write this in the space of 700 words, but we're in 2014. The four core issues of the Arab-Israeli conflict have been kicked around long enough with Jerusalem, border security, and refugees. It's time that the United States put down a position, and I mean put it down and publish it on the internet, and say, Right. This is the 1967 border. This is our position on it, on Jerusalem, on security, on refugees. This is where we stand. It's a take it or leave it. And if they leave it, then they can chart their own path. But we keep going this method of going with the Israelis, seeing if they'll reject it first. Of course they do. The Palestinians then, you know, don't trust what we present to them. We need to have our own independent ideas. And they need to incorporate the last several decades of negotiations.
Again, I'm speaking with Clayton Swisher, who's the manager of investigative journalism for Al Jazeera, based in Doha, Qatar. He's the author of The Truth About Camp David and The Palestine Papers, The End of the Road, based on 1,600 files of leaked confidential records of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks entrusted to him and published by Al Jazeera and The Guardian in 2011. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Isn't It Time to Try Something New? Now, in terms of the files that were leaked to you, the 1,600 files of confidential records of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, known as the Palestine Papers, they, of course, in a sense, from my recollection, was a kind of a plague on both their houses. I mean, it didn't do the Palestinians. They certainly didn't come out in a good light, too, in terms of just on the surface. If you've been at this thing for decades and gotten nowhere, then maybe you need a new team. I mean, it reminds me of that adage of Einstein's, if you keep repeating the same thing, expecting a different outcome, that's a definition of let's say at least failure. So,
well, no, it's insanity. I mean, they had also a heavily pro-Israel team under the Bush administration. The Palestinians, as seen in the Palestine paper, were under the cloud of 9/11 American policy, which was, you better act like good Arabs and show that you're with us rather than against us. And so this led to a lot of fear in the Palestinian negotiating position, I would say even bending towards American concessions and Israeli concessions in ways that hadn't been done under Yasser Arafat. And it still wasn't good enough for the Israelis. Saab Erekat, who resigned as a result of this leak, was quoted as telling Sivi Lipni, who's the chief negotiator till today, that we're offering you the largest Jerusalem ever. What more do you want? And what they wanted more of course, was settlements, which they continue to grow until now. So the Israelis, even now, they try to get the Palestinians caught up in these rhetorical battles, as recognize us as a Jewish state, etc. But they won't tell us to recognize their boundaries. They won't tell the Americans what they want their boundaries to be, because they keep growing them, and the United States allows them to grow these boundaries. So it's clear that they're not willing to resolve the conflict, and that they want to continue growing their state. And this is what came through in the Palestine papers. Even as they were negotiating, the Israelis were continuing to build settlements. The Palestinians complained. The Americans turned a tin ear. What came through, particularly to the Arab audience, was the amount of and the level of concessions the Palestinians made that hadn't been made before, and it still wasn't good enough for the Israelis. So we can imagine now what those conversations sound like. I mean, the starting point isn't 2000, of course. The starting point was what was discussed under President Bush's tenure. And you can only imagine that under Netanyahu, that those positions have been further eroded and reduced. And it begs the question of whether, if there isn't strong American leadership, is there even going to be a plan that any Arab would accept? Mahmoud Abbas is well beyond his term and has dubious popularity and credibility, having expired his term as president. So you have to wonder if they do strong arm a deal through on the Palestinian side, whether the public will accept it in any way. And again, this is owing to, years of trying the same thing, the same biased mediation, the same auto deference to the Israeli side, and expecting a different result.
So, Clayton Swisher, you mentioned Tzipi Livni, the justice minister and the Israeli's government's chief negotiator with the Palestinians. She has already blamed Uri Ariel, the housing minister, for deliberately scuttling and sabotaging this latest round of peace talks by building these extra 700 settlements. And she also has complained that too much time is wasted negotiating with Americans rather than Palestinians. So it seems to me that not only is there a sense of futility on the Palestinian side or questioning the process on the Palestinian side, there's also at least some people on the Israeli side questioning the process.
That's right. I mean, the fact is the Israelis need a process right now to provide a fig leaf to the rest of the world. Otherwise, they're on the ropes getting beat up. There's a BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that's gaining traction, not just, you know, across Europe, but in the United States, particularly in the European Union. And if the Israelis can't say that they're negotiating and negotiating in good faith, then much of the world's criticism it bears down on them at a time when they want the world to cooperate with them on things like Iran. So they need this fig leaf. And, you know, the United States has so far been the only one to step up to it and been providing Israel the cover to continue its actions. And it begs the question why. President Obama is in his second term. He's not facing a re-election, so no one's going to say things that are going to hurt him politically because he's already been president twice at this point, and the Constitution doesn't allow more. So one would think that he's able and free of domestic political constraints to take bold peacemaking steps. But what we see is, you know, maybe indifference, maybe sympathy, but he's not acting on it. There's a time to call a spade. And Secretary Kerry, I think, came, my analysis from his remarks in the Senate, whereas he came as close to calling a spade by saying, when the Israelis announced the settlements, poof, that was it. That's as close as the United States will ever come to blaming Israel for anything. But, of course, you could argue that he's saying it in a territory, the U.S. Congress, which is the most pro-Israeli territory in the United States, that, you know, no one really cares.
Israeli negotiator is saying the same thing. So can't we quote her? Can't the American press quote the Israeli justice minister and negotiator who's saying exactly what Kerry's saying? She's blaming the housing minister.
If the U.S. Congress didn't know that it was Tzvi Livni saying that they would probably call her an anti-Semite. I mean, that's just how ridiculous and that's how lacking in knowledge the U.S. Congress has become on this issue and how just sophomoric they are in their approach to, like I said, core national security items. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a key incubator for anger directed at the United States across the Arab and Muslim world. It's not just the Middle East. It's from Malaysia to Mali. And it's not the sole reason. No, it's not. But it's a major one in terms of looking at it like pollution. Addressing this is going upstream to the source of the smokestack. And the United States is incredible. After 9/11, there was no credible review of what American policies do to cause people to hate us. Rather, we just waged more war against people and fought them wherever we could find them, but without making any adjustments in our policies because, you know, God forbid that would be seen as a capitulation or kowtowing to the enemy. But it's silly. One would think that we had passed that era as the Bush years came to a close, but really we've done we've not acted on any self-diagnosis of what the past American Middle East policy failures have been, and that's because we keep recycling the same retreads, people with bad ideas. It's like it's required to be an appointee in any political administration. I'm not talking about career diplomats. I'm talking about the appointees on Middle East policy. You must be pro-Israeli, and you must be consistently wrong to assume a position in any administration. It's farcical.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Clayton Swisher, let's turn to the latest news in terms of these tenuous and arguably collapsed peace talks, or at least the latest round of this process, which is really about a process, not about peace. Yuval Steinitz, the Israeli intelligence minister, has told in an interview with the UK Telegraph, has said that if the Palestinian leadership cancels its application to join 15 international conventions, then they could make a deal, but only if the Americans were to free Jonathan Pollard. So, we're back to square one. the reason that Kerry gave in on Pollard was that he's only got a year and a half to go, and this was something that would be helpful to Netanyahu to placate his right flank. But here's the right flank coming back, and it seems to me that if Netanyahu is really serious about this process, he could reform a coalition with the left and with Livni and company. But he's still clearly happy with his right-wing coalition because that's where he's really at.
Well, here's my thoughts on this. on canceling the applications, there's going to be a return to sender. Now that he's mailed it to the UN, he's going to ask them to just pretend they didn't get it. Politically, how's he going to do that?
I should have mentioned this. The quid pro quo is the release of 26 prisoners, and that's
okay. Well, yeah. I don't think 26 prisoners are going to matter at this point. If a boss is already on the ropes politically, if having called all the cameras in the world to come and watch him sign these 15 applications, he now reneges. It's not just his people who won't take him seriously. It's all those 15 international bodies who are expecting to receive and process his application. So that's the first thing. That he'd basically be saying that, no, I didn't mean it. We're not really ready to be a state yet. The bigger issue here, though, is what's the threat here? The threat, the international community, the United States, the Israelis, they call on Palestinians to reject all forms of violence. Okay, fine. They call on them to not resist the occupation that is violent and canceling their freedom and their rights. But at the same time, when they go to pursue legal measures, and we're talking legal. This is using lawyers and diplomats, nonviolent legal instruments like the United Nations and the courts. They're terrified. It's as if they're holding a gun to their collective head. And the reason for this is, of course, because of accountability and the sunlight that this will bring onto their activities. And the implications it'll have under international law that they fear. And so why the United States would be against anyone asserting their UN-protected legal rights, it's incredible. It is incredible, and it's hypocritical to those Hobbesian values that Americans are supposed to stand for, life, liberty, and property, that we would deny another people their ability to make claims and to seek legal means to defend their life, their liberty, their property. With the Pollard release, I mean, this is, it's again, farcical. Why is the United States considering releasing a man convicted of spying against, you know, a devastating disclosure to Israel in the 1980s? This is in Israel's interest to have a peace process. The United States should not, you know, one would think, be asked to throw in sweeteners like releasing a person who did devastating intelligence damage. And not only that, based as an analyst looking at the U.S. intelligence community, they've taken a lot of hits for their poor performance over the years. Is that the message that the Obama administration wants to send to them? Not only you got to reform yourself because you're exceeding your limits and having numerous failures, but also if some of you decide to spy, we'll release you if it involves Israel. I mean, it sends a terrible message to anyone who would consider working in the national security community that there's an exception if anything involves Israel. And that's why it hasn't been done until now. And, you know, it would really show a level of desperation that it would be humiliating, I would think, to the United States to go there.
Well, Clayton Swisher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Clayton Swisher, who's the manager of investigative journalism for Al Jazeera, based in Doha, Qatar. He's the author of The Truth About Camp David and The Palestine Papers, The End of the Road, based on 1,600 files of leaked confidential records of the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks entrusted to him and published by Al Jazeera and The Guardian in 2011. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Isn't It Time to Try Something New? And the opinions he expressed in this interview were his own, not those of Al Jazeera. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how America is rigged for the rich. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. Oh, all of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizen University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Liu.
Ian, thank you for having me.
And Paul Ryan, the congressman who ran as vice president on the Republican vice presidential ticket in the last election, also has put forth the Republican budget. He has recently stated that he has a problem with the culture of poverty. You're arguing in your CNN piece that actually the real problem is the culture of concentrated wealth.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think the argument that Paul Ryan has been making recently about the so-called culture of poverty isn't a Paul Ryan original. There have been people for decades actually saying essentially that the reason why poor people in America are poor is that they have bad habits, bad values, and are part of a bad culture. And, you know, put aside for a moment the pure kind of blame the victim morality of that. The larger point that I'm trying to make right now is that we are living through this unbelievable, nearly unprecedented period of radical inequality, both income and wealth, and radical concentration of wealth and opportunity. And when you have this kind of concentration where the, you know, it's not just what the 1% have, but it's now getting to really what the 0.1 and the 0.01% both have in terms of income and wealth and the ability that they have to convert their outsized wealth into outsized voice in our politics, says to me that really the greater, deeper threat to our democracy, to our social cohesion, to our moral fabric, isn't the culture of poverty, if you even believe that exists. It's this culture of wealth that says that, hey, we should just be completely every man for himself, and if few people end up hoarding you know, the great gains, if 400 families end up having more wealth than a million Americans, as is the case today, then so be it. And that, to me, is a far greater threat, both morally and practically, to the viability of our democracy than anything that's going on, as Paul Ryan focuses on, in our inner cities.
Well, it seems like Paul Ryan, who apparently has been heavily influenced by Ayn Rand's writings, and of course the Catholic nuns on the bus visited him in the last presidential election to test his Catholic faith, which he advertises in terms of his adherence to Ayn Rand's philosophies. But she's basically arguing that altruism is a sin and selfishness is a virtue. And it would seem that beating up on the poor or the least among us, you know, picking on the poor seems to be a cheap shot when the real argument here, and I take it the one that you're putting forth, is that we have a rigged system where we don't have a level playing field. We don't have the Horatio Alger pull yourself up kind of opportunities. We are no longer the land of opportunity. And that's the issue we should be addressing. And by beating up on the poor, you're basically changing the subject.
Well, you're not just changing the subject when you beat up on the poor. You actually are, you know, it's a classic case of what psychologists call projection, right? The things that often conservative critics of the poor say are characteristic of the quote-unquote culture of poverty are things like short-term thinking, you know, a lack of personal responsibility, unwillingness to play by social norms and rules, kind of scoffing at the idea of being of productive work, this kind of shameless materialism and this inability to defer gratification, right? And you get a lot of people scolding poor inner city, often people of color, for exhibiting these things. And I'm not saying these patterns of behavior and these norms don't exist among the poor, but the great irony is that there is no better case study or exhibit for all of those dysfunctional values and those dysfunctional aspects of culture than on Wall Street today. You know, tribal insularity, short-term thinking, personal irresponsibility, this kind of, you know, avoidance of being productive contributors to society. And to me, I think there is this idea that it's bad enough that we're picking on those who are weakest and have the least. It's even worse that those doing the bullying are the very ones exhibiting the antisocial behaviors. And, you know, I think the larger point that you allude to here is the riggedness of the game, right? If we had a truly free market, indeed, if there could ever be such a thing as a truly free market, as if markets somehow were ordained by God before government existed. But if we had a truly fair market, even we wouldn't have a situation where the top 1% were able to triple their share of national income over the last three decades. That tripling, that concentration, is the predictable result of a deliberate effort to rig the rules of the game. Tax rules, subsidy rules, rules of policymaking, rules that treat some kind of income as taxable and others less so, and rules that over and over again favor unearned capital over hard-earned work. And that, to me, is something that is, again, not just morally repugnant. It's just stupid and self-destructive. It undermines our economy when you have that much of our nation's wealth and lifeblood concentrated in so few hands. And it also undermines our democracy.
Again, I'm speaking with Eric Liu, who's the founder of Citizens University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. Well, it seems, though, that much of these arguments don't, as you pointed out earlier, they don't just come from Paul Ryan. In many ways, they are a part of the Republican strategy, I think, to hold on to the so-called endangered white man, with afraid that the demographic shifts underway in this country are going to marginalize the white man, and the notion being that that somehow you can keep racism alive, in effect, by suggesting either in code or quite openly that welfare is for minorities, for lazy minorities. I mean, the subtext of much of the opposition to the Affordable Care Act is that we're going to have a bunch of freeloaders now on the government dime, on your dime, and it's going to cause your premiums to go up. And they've been very successful in framing that the Obamacare in that way. And the White House has been much less successful in pointing out the virtues of it. So clearly, this will be an election year topic. What can be done to undermine that constant message that I think is in many ways keeping racism alive?
Well, Ian, I think you're right in part, and I think there's also a part that's even bigger than this aspect. So, the first thing I would say is that there's no question that we're in a time where so much of national politics, but particularly so much of Republican politics, is a reaction to these profound demographic shifts and the diminishment of the both. Numbers and actual cultural clout and political clout, relatively speaking, of the white electorate and white men in particular. The Republican Party nationally has thus far been making a bet that they can keep on squeezing votes out of a disaffected majority that is kind of beginning to foresee its minority status. In a short-term way, there is a certain amount of rationalism in that strategy. You can get people fired up in an angry, white, disaffected, alienated base. But number one, that's no long-term strategy for even building a majority party. And number two, it's certainly no strategy for actually unifying the country, right? Demographics are, to a great extent, destiny. Not that any Republican's asking me for advice, but frankly, if I were a Republican, I'd be pivoting in the direction of Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, who recently said, much to the dismay of many of his more extreme party colleagues, that if that party is going to be a going concern nationally in our politics over the next generation, they've got to learn in deed as well as word to become more inclusive and to really think about how they frame their aspirations and their policies in terms that are not pivoting off of and against a boogeyman of poor people of color, but actually find ways to make them part of the story. This goes to the second thing that I would say, Ian, which is, there's no question that race has always been and is today now being exploited in our politics, and that race is often used as this clumsy proxy for struggles that are going on of class. There is great class status anxiety in our country now, in a shrinking middle class, and it's really easy to find race-colored scapegoats for that anxiety. The thing I'd say, though, to you know, not to be just kind of monolithically partisan here, is that, quite frankly, Democrats in many cases have bought in as much as Republicans have in this notion that the way an economy becomes healthy, the way that we get prosperity, is to buy into a trickle-down vision that says if we take care of a few people at the top, their wealth will magically somehow leak down to the rest of us. Though Republicans have been the ones mainly advancing that idea, Democrats, either simply by default or by inattentiveness or by failure to posit an affirmative alternative, have essentially let it happen, and in some cases have actually bought into it whole hog. And I think, you know, to your bottom line question of what do we do, what do we, just the citizens and the listeners to this conversation, to start changing this, part of what we have to do is just question the explanations that are being peddled to us by people of both parties for how we actually build both a prosperous economy and an actual democracy. And the way we do that isn't by continuing to feed more and more into the hands of fewer and fewer people at the top. The way we build an economy and the way we revive a democracy is from the middle out, not the top down. And I think this middle out philosophy is something that we, certainly I as a progressive, feel like it's imperative right now to be pushing.
But isn't don't statistics bear it out, Eric Liu, that the majority of people in poverty, the majority of people on food stamps and welfare, are in fact white?
Yeah, that is true. The majority, and you know, I mean, and, right. There's no question that you know, and well, first of all, the majority of people who are poor are white, and second of all, the majority of dollars that are being spent in this country on what you might call welfare are being spent on the rich, not the poor.
Sure. You know, we have right-wing welfare. We're unique amongst the advanced democracies in that regard. Agribusiness, the military-industrial complex, it is pretty breathtaking.
But even just in the tax code, I mean, the way we have tax expenditures and tax preferences that are tilted overwhelmingly toward the already affluent, I mean, it's again, it would be fine if we had just a neutral system, but we have a system that actively is trying to feed more advantage and more wealth to those already with advantage and wealth in how we count things either as taxable or as shielded from tax.
So, Eric Liu, I must say that the Democrats' only strategy to win back, not that they're likely to win back the House, but at least to hold on to the Senate in this election year, seems to be to scapegoat the Koch brothers and blame them for everything. And there's no question that the Koch brothers are politically active, but they're not behind everything, as a lot of people think. And it would seem that that is a bankrupt policy. Why not come up with a real program to revive a level playing field, to revive entrepreneurship, to give the people in this country who aren't getting a fair shake a fair shake?
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, look, I'm no fan of the Koch brothers, but I think an electoral strategy built on demonizing them is implicitly an admission that your goal is to minimize your losses, right? They're just trying to get enough of a base activated, a base that already knows vaguely about who the Koch brothers are and gets exercised about you know, the power they wield to show up at the polls to stop some of the expected bleeding in these midterm elections. But you're absolutely right that there is an affirmative case to be made, an affirmative argument for progressives to make about how from the middle out and from the bottom up we can actually rebuild this economy and get purchasing power and demand growing again and actually get the you know, opportunity flowing. And that is just a you know, a story that right now, particularly because many Democrats are just scared, and they're scared that they're going to lose, and they're scared that the Affordable Care Act is going to drag them down, which, by the way, I don't think it will. I think in a few months' time, it will be less toxic than it is today, and in a couple of years' time, people are going to be saying, do you remember back when the failure of the website for ACA originally made everybody think the whole thing was doomed? Gosh, that was crazy. That was back before we had 20 million people, you know, with insurance now and people buying into this and believing this. But in the short term, with midterm elections coming up in a few months, I think too many Democrats are operating out of fear and therefore, as you suggest, Ian, not really thinking first about how to put forward an affirmative story for why they should win.
So just in closing then, Eric Liu, is it a chicken and egg situation here? If we are losing our democracy and becoming more and more of a plutonomy or a plutocracy, and the Supreme Court has enabled their last couple of rulings, Citizens United and in particular McCutcheon, seem to suggest that somehow billionaires are beleaguered and they need special preference in elections, and therefore we have to open the floodgates entirely. And so given that if you create a political system that's based on money or is about money, then he who has the most money owns the most politics. So given that situation, what do you think can be done then to get to that program that we talked about, which is the need for a real program to rescue the middle class, to level the playing field, to allow entrepreneurship and the American dream not to be a slogan and a bankrupt slogan at that, but a reality?
Well, it's a great question, and this really goes to the work that I do with my organization, Citizen University. Our work is all about just re-empowering, indeed reawakening people to their often dormant power as citizens. I think there is a chicken and egg, or at least a vicious circle dynamic where economic inequality begets political inequality, which begets more economic inequality, and after a while people feel voiceless and powerless, and they feel more like spectators, and they feel like, what's the point of showing up as a citizen? The reason why I don't think it's ultimately a chicken and egg thing is we can break it. We can actually break that cycle. And, you know, yes, our politics has gotten more rigged than ever before. And yes, the Supreme Court has just, you know, made it even easier for money to accelerate its grip on our politics. But at the end of the day, you know, there are hundreds of millions of us who actually have the right to vote. Only less than a majority of us actually exercise that right. If the number who are eligible to vote voted in this country, then no amount of Koch brothers, no amount of plutocrats at the top could actually force through their policies. No, and their actions and choices and their rigging of today's game do not actually work to deny you and me the choice to say, you know what, today I'm actually going to vote. Today I'm actually going to get 10, 20, 30 other people I know to vote. It sounds old-fashioned and corny, but it remains the most powerful, leveling, equalizing thing to do to exercise the franchise and to remember and, you know, by exercising the franchise, remember that in the end, there's 99% of us. and if we actually show up, we can change our politics.
Well, Eric Liu, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Liu, the founder of Citizens University and the author of several books, including The Gardens of Democracy and The Accidental Asian. He previously served as a White House speechwriter and policy advisor for President Bill Clinton and has an article at CNN, How America is Rigged for the Rich. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.